Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the study of the early Christian movement and its implications for the church today. Today we are joined by Michael, our resident ephesiologist. I'm Andrew Johnson, pastor at Neartown Church in Houston, Texas. And today we are joined by Dr. Andrew Whitehead, Associate Professor of Sociology at IUPUI. He is the co-author of Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States, and the author of the recently published American Idolatry, How Christian Nationalism Betrays the Gospel and Threatens the Church. Dr. Whitehead, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast today.
Yeah, it's good to be with you both. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, okay, we're excited about your book and excited about the work that you've been doing. I know Andrew and I have been following it since 2020, when your 2020, wasn't it? When your first book came out. And so we've appreciated what you've been doing.
Yeah, thank you so much. I do appreciate that.
Before we get into the nitty gritty, the fun parts of the book, help our listeners understand a bit who you are. Maybe what are three important facts that you would love for people to know about you?
Three important facts. You're putting me on the spot here.
Yes, sir.
I am a sociologist, social scientist, study American religion, particularly using survey data, trying to understand how religion shapes our social worlds and also how our social world shapes religion in the U.S. context. And so I graduated from Baylor in 2012, and so I've been doing it for a little while now. I grew up in Indiana, northern Indiana, small town. Going to church regularly, and that has been a part of my journey, and my faith has been a part of that journey. And, continuing to learn and grow and trying to find and think through both in my professional work as a sociologist, how religion, is and should be used in the public square and in civil society, and thinking too through myself with Christianity, how that integrates and intersects. So I don't know if that's three facts, but that's a little bit about me.
we could pull three out of there, I bet.
I mean, that's some good color. That's some good color. It really does help us know you.
You were at Baylor at an interesting time, weren't you? I mean, so Rodney Stark comes. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that you got to know him.
No, actually, it's not true. So I was there when he was affiliated with Baylor. I was there 07 to 2012, and he had gotten there, I don't know, a number of years before then. But he lived, I think it was in Arizona. And so he was affiliated with Baylor, and Baylor would be on the books that he wrote. But I saw him twice.
Okay.
In my 5 years there, and talked to him on the phone once for maybe like 5 minutes. But other than that, no other interaction with Dr.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, he was so formative in the sociology of religion. A huge part of my doctoral work focused on his theory of religious innovation. And even today, as we're thinking about movements around the world, that theory has a lot of relevance to understanding not just new religious movements, but Christian movements as well. So we've appreciated his work. Now, was Gordon Melton there? Did he get there but when you were there?
I think was affiliated, but I don't know that he was ever on campus. He may be in Waco now, but that was since I've left. I don't actually know where he is. So
he waited till that Magnolia boom happened, right? And then he decided to come back to Waco.
Yeah. And we moved away before that happened.
Exactly.
So Waco is very different now than what you remember. So
have you gone back to Baylor and been there around the whole Magnolia world?
I have once. So in 2019, I was able to visit again. And it had really changed. Waco had definitely changed in that time.
Well, now, I mean, this is like hometown week, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like.
Yeah.
I was there on campus giving a lecture at a Chesner conference in 2000. When was that? 2000. I don't remember when it was. I think you would have been there. Maybe I'm not probably not at the conference, but at the university at the time. And I remember our the family went down. It was the summer, so we could all travel. So we took a road trip to Waco, and our kids hated it. The only good memory they had was the swimming pool at the hotel, and even that was a little suspect. But they were so thankful to get out of that city.
Waco, we will not. We will not hold your past against you.
Yeah,
well, and they didn't even get to see the Dr. Pepper Museum or the what's the Texas Rangers
Museum.
Yeah. Well, I think as a grad student, and then my wife and I were relatively newly married, and then we had our first two kids there. There wasn't, you know, we didn't have a lot of time for anything really, and so that town was great. It was kind of a sleepy, quiet town at that point. So
there's a great lake there. That huge, what I can't remember what it was called. Anyway, we used to go out, and I lived not too far from there when I was younger. But anyway,
I will force us back on topic.
Thank you,
because I am too excited. This is all things Texas. We've been talking off mic about Indiana, now on mic about Texas. This is all great. Dr. Whitehead, you and Dr. Perry wrote what might be considered kind of that seminal work, the place that a lot of people are going to define what is Christian nationalism. It's quoted and referenced by literally everybody who's trying to get their bearings on it. Mm-hmm. So why did you decide, I just want to run it back in a different way? Why did you write the book American Idolatry?
Yeah, it's a great question. And at first, I actually didn't want to write it. Brazos reached out and thought, hey, could you write something to pastors or to Christians about Christian nationalism and helping with kind of taking the work that you did and what does it mean and how do they respond? And, you know, not being a pastor myself or, you know, with extensive theological training or anything like that, I just felt like, I don't know that I, you know, I'm the person to do this. And so I kind of said, you know, maybe not. But then, you know, over some more conversations, I realized that, you know, I've been on this journey personally for years now, thinking through my Christian faith, how it intersects with how, you know, I live it out in the public sphere, others too. And then, having built up a number of years as a social scientist studying this, that I did have something to say and thinking about what this means for the church, for the gospel, for Christianity, for American Christians. And so that started that process then for me of thinking through how to share that journey in some ways, to bring together that professional journey and what I've learned with my personal journey of wrestling through this and still being on that journey, right? It isn't as though I've arrived and now here is, you know, here's the answer. Mm-hmm. But that these are questions that we need to continue to wrestle with and to try and start conversations so people can, wherever they're at, plug into the journey and continue on. And not even that we'll all agree on everything, but that there are aspects of it that I think we need to have deep conversations about. And so that was really what prompted me and encouraged me to write this book and the kind of the posture I tried to take throughout writing it and now talking about it.
How would you differentiate this volume from your previous one that you did with Sam Perry?
Yeah, well, I think it is different in a number of ways. So there are no figures or tables in this book. And so those
darn, that's what I don't like about it.
Yeah, I would rather not see that than that's not there. And, you know, with our first book, we really laid it out to a broader audience, but firmly, you know, from the social science of defining what it is empirically and showing all that work that we'd been doing leading up to the book. And then since then, with Taking America Back for God, I should say. And then for this book, it really does begin in that foundation of having done the work empirically and drawing on the social science. But then, you know, I take a step further and there are normative claims that I make within this book about what I, you know, believe and in reading others, what various expressions of Christianity, how they might define the gospel, that I think is more in tune than a gospel that would be embraced by Christian nationalism. And so in that sense, it is based on that empirical work and foundation, but it moves beyond. And is there are aspects that are more personal with my own journey and trying to just highlight, you know, where I've come from and where I'm going as an example and hopefully to invite others along in that journey.
Hmm. How was that for you as you were trying to, again, not that this is a departure from the sociology work, but it's a continuation. However, like you're saying, this feels so much more gospel focused, Jesus centered than taking America back. Sure. So how was that for you personally, having to make that, I am now taking my data and I am turning it both inward and outward? How was that for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I appreciate it because, you know, it was difficult at times because it was a different type of writing, different style of writing. And so even writing Taking America Back for God was a different style than, you know, a lot of the writing that I or Sam had done within our peer review journals, right? And wanting to reach a broader audience with that work. And then for this one, you know, speaking specifically to fellow Christians, it's a different audience that I'm aiming at. And so it was, yeah, a process of learning how to do that. And then to, you know, just striking, you know, what I hoped was the right tone of invitation and not shying away from difficult parts or critiques or difficult histories, but trying to place that in context with where we're going, where we hope to go, and also trying to provide some hope too. But as you both know, writing is difficult no matter what it is, whether it's peer review to just other academics or, you know, our first book to a broader public, but relying on that, you know, that scholarship. And then this one that draws in more personal aspects and, you know, includes parts where, yeah, moving beyond the data to what does this mean and what do we do about it and telling some of those stories. So it was challenging in a good way. And some days, you know, it felt like, is this ever going to come together? But grateful for support, you know, along the way. So yeah, it was an interesting and challenging experience.
What surprised you in both books, in the Taking America Back for God and then in this volume, American Idolatry?
Yeah. You know, I think the thing that's been most surprising about Taking America Back for God for me that I'm coming to appreciate more and more is how it has reached well beyond, you know, our social scientific kind of area and really been used by folks who are, yeah, pastoring churches or who are working in different areas of academia and influence, you know, different parts of the conversation and bringing this term to bear. And some of that is it just coming at a moment, you know, where historically mm-hmm. things were happening where it just really was applicable. And
absolutely,
that isn't true for every book. So I think that's been, you know, more kind of surprising to me as it's gone on of just how kind of unique that experience continues to be, but was. And I think for this book, what's been most surprising, you know, it's been challenging talking about it with, you know, putting some of your own personal journey in the book mm-hmm. as I did, and where I'll have critiques from people that are, you know, much further right politically, religiously, and much further left politically or religiously, or even outside the faith, where, yeah, there are folks, you know, on either end that will be upset with something. And that can be difficult too. And so trying to, you know, find a place where we can have conversation or encourage that conversation, I think, yeah, that's been the part that I've been surprised about is just some of that work is quite difficult in speaking to dramatically different groups with a lot of different views of what the social world should look like and who should be allowed to participate. And so that mm-hmm. has been surprising to me.
Mm. What about in terms of conclusions? Were there conclusions that surprised you from your research?
Yeah, that's always a difficult one to answer because it does take a while. So by the end, you probably don't remember what surprised you.
it was 4 years ago.
Yeah, there's that part of it too. You know, I think for me with writing this book, it could be surprising, but I think, you know, was always challenging was, you know, relying on history and good history and historians and theologians writing about the history of Christianity in the United States, continuing to kind of peel the layers back. That can be really difficult and challenging to see things that fellow Christians were involved in and argued explicitly for using scripture, you know, to marginalize, oppress, and then sometimes, you know, kill and physically harm other human beings. That can always be difficult work. And so it was for me in writing it, I know for some in reading it. And so that kind of that burden, I think, too, is always difficult and just takes effort. So and not that it was surprising, but yeah, just continuing to peel back, you know, different layers and stories, that was always something new as you continued to do that.
You wrote American Idolatry and specifically about white Christian nationalism. In the book, you lay out as clear as day, and then after laying it out, spend all your time to kind of going underneath that thought of, okay, there are three main things: power, fear, violence. Power, fear, violence. These are the three points of the trident that is white Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. However, it's not like you're writing a history book looking back 100 years ago. This was a really big thing. Where are you right now seeing Christian nationalism keep trying to assert itself through power, fear, and violence in 2023?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it is something that, you know, in the book and writing it and my continued work, it is quite easy to have kind of current examples and then go back in history and see those same things happen, right? These same mechanisms. And so, yeah, with the recently elected Speaker of the House, you know, some of the themes of power, fear, and then I think as power and fear are used to demarcate, you know, the quote unquote us from the them and what this nation should look like, that necessarily leans into violence and can result in that. And so, you know, looking at some of the things that he has said or claimed about minorities of different types, and when he looks and talks about in his recent speech after being elected, that, you know, he and others are God's anointed and placing that upon himself, that he is there for a specific purpose that God has ordained. We see.
I haven't heard that. Did he make that in his speech the other night or yesterday?
Yeah. So the use of drawing on Romans 13:1, right? That, that we're here, all here, you know, he's talking to his colleagues for a specific purpose and that they're anointed. And so, that God raises up authority for specific times and, you know, he and those there are that authority. And so, you know, we still see this rhetoric, this narrative in play and in his past writings too, seeing the United States as distinctively Christian and created to align with, you know, biblical values. And again, biblical is doing a lot of work there of what that means to him or to the groups he's a part of. And so I think those are real time examples of this working towards power that is, as I write in the book, you know, a self-interested power to benefit the us, the in-group, because it believes in you know, folks that embrace it view that this is the only way to adhere to God's principles for this country and this nation, and we must do that. And to do that, we have to have power, and to be afraid to say that. For instance, if the United States legalizes same-sex marriage, that it will lead it down a path of decay and destruction. And those are things that, you know, he has written in response to same-sex marriage in the U.S. So whether Christians, you know, in good faith agree or disagree with that stance, you know, there's a lot of discussion that can be had there. But the use of fear that for Christians who in good faith come to the conclusion that, you know, same-sex marriage should or could be legal in the U.S., to say that they're somehow outside the faith And to embrace that means that they're encouraging the destruction of the U.S. I think that's where we see the fear get fomented. And so those are some of the examples that we see happening, you know, just within this week.
Yeah, I would say we didn't have to go very far. Now, I will say, I have to shame myself for this. I think we all three just jumped right into the topic of Christian nationalism because it was like, well, we've read the book and this is a common talking point. Maybe our listeners aren't so familiar. Let take it from this way. For somebody who's going to say, okay, I want my society to reflect more of God and his ways. And it seems that these people are saying, the people that are being accused of being Christian nationalists or showing some of those, I don't want to say tendencies, they're associated with that mindset. They say they just want to have this place where I live look more and more like God. What's so wrong about that? What would you say to those who they don't see the problem?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, ultimately we have to recognize that we live in a country where there is a growing level of religious diversity and racial and ethnic diversity more than ever before. And so if we're going to live in a place that does, you know, abide by the ideals of a pluralistic democratic society, it doesn't mean that they can't advocate for certain views, be a part of that discussion, but ultimately have to abide by the shared value of other groups will be able to have a say as well, and that we're all a part of this discussion. And one group or one particular expression of Christianity and the views and cultural values that come with that about, well, this is how society should look, that one expression shouldn't have the ultimate say. And so I think that's where the distinction lies. So it isn't as though Christians shouldn't partake and be a part of the civil sphere. I think to be Christian and not, you know, is actually worse. Like, we need to be a part of it. We need to have our voices heard and integrate and be a part of that discussion. But I think we should think deeply about to whose benefit. Right. And who are we working to benefit? And is it something that is just based out of fear of the quote unquote them, these other groups who we fear are going to take something away from us? Or are we working within the public sphere toward a common good and a flourishing of all people? And I think to do that, we have to really wrestle with defending the right of other folks to believe differently than us. Right. So a religious freedom and liberty that we understand and recognize that if we are the minority, how would we want to be treated? And to make sure that we act in the social sphere in the same way and treating other groups with that type of respect. And so what we find empirically is that Americans who embrace Christian nationalism, they tend to want to either ignore or do away with some of those values and beliefs, that it isn't about allowing other groups to take part, but it's about being, you know, the voice in the room and enacting a particular vision over and against what other groups might see and believe. And so I say all this and not with some kind of naivete that this is going to be easy or that it is easy. It will be difficult and it will be hard and it will take working together and compromise. But valuing the having those values of a democratic system be at the forefront, and then again bringing, you know, our vision of the world and for the world within that to the flourishing of other groups, I think is a way that we can start to do that.
How would you, Andrew? So many things are running through my brain right now, and I appreciate so much the work that you guys have done on the issue of Christian nationalism. How would you distinguish that from what might be perceived as a threat of nationalism in general?
That's a really good question. And I think, you know, religious nationalism, there isn't anything particular or unique about Christianity that makes it more or less likely to be kind of involved in religious nationalism as any other world religion, right? And there isn't anything unique about the United States where we see it cropping up. Other countries in the world have various types of religious nationalism taking place. And in prior centuries, other countries, you know, Christianity was a part of that religious nationalism. And so I think understanding that, it helps kind of, I hope, turn the temperature down a little bit, where it isn't anything about the US or Christianity that makes it necessarily unique, but it is the religious nationalism that we're working with right here and now. And I think, you know, whether or not that is so different from nationalism writ large, I think, you know, religion and religious nationalism is a part of that greater whole, where nationalism can encompass more than that. But religion, I think, is so powerfully related to it, because it legitimates some of those nationalistic tendencies and desires of placing a country or a people above others and to the other's detriment. It legitimates that in the will of the sacred, right? Whether it's the Christian God or another world religion, their God or gods. And that is so powerful, because when God has said, you people, right, this nation, you are chosen, you are mine, and that nation believes that, they can then act in impunity in many ways. And we see that historically, right? Christians believing that they are acting upon the will of God, doing horrific things to other humans. And again, it isn't as though other world religions don't do that as well.
Right.
We're working here in the U.S. with our unique history. And so in that sense, we're looking at Christianity. So I think in that sense, nationalism is that broader term. But religion is such a key part of that, because of the power that it has to legitimate what those arguments are in the will of the sacred.
And you write in the book that, and I found this interesting, because the rhetoric that we hear makes or gives the impression that this Christian nationalism is growing, but in fact, you're suggesting it's not.
Right. Yeah. No. So empirically, I mean, so when journalists reach out, they would love to write the headline, right, that this is growing like wildfire, but it really isn't. So when we measure Christian nationalism across the American public, the group of Americans, because it's a spectrum, people can embrace it more or less strongly. Those at the very upper end of our scale who embrace it very strongly, that group is shrinking. So most recent data, it's like 14-15%. And, you know, a decade ago, it was 19-20%. Depending on how we measure it, that group can be even smaller. Those that really advocate for a Christian nation could be 9 or 10%. So they're getting smaller, and it's relative minority. Now, in the voting population, they do make up a larger proportion based on their sociodemographics, right? They're very motivated, tend to be white natural born citizens, and so easy access to the democratic process. But I think what makes it seem like it's, you know, growing in a sense, is the rhetoric and the power kind of within the social consciousness of this group is rather large. And that, I think, is due to some social mechanisms at play. So as groups get smaller, what ties that group together becomes even more salient in setting it apart from those who are not in the group. And so as ambassadors or Americans who strongly embrace Christian nationalism decline in number, what draws them together is their embrace of Christian nationalism. And that's what makes them different from everyone else. And so they embrace that identity. It becomes more salient to them. And so they see it, you know, they see their social worlds and their differences from others through that lens. And so I think that's what makes the group and Christian nationalism of importance right now, even if it is getting smaller, it's becoming more salient to those that strongly embrace it. And that can have implications for all of us, I think.
And the example is what we were just talking about with the recent Speaker of the House, isn't it? That rhetoric, if it's being used to legitimize or a divine legitimization of the speaker's position and the position of America in the world and so on, then yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, and I think that's a really good point too, is in the work of others highlighting, you know, folks that embrace it in positions of power. So they can
that's
be
it.
Few in
yep.
number, but if
yep.
they're in the positions of power, can pull those levers of power, that really matters for everyone, even if very few Americans, you know, would agree with the new speaker's vision, right, of mm-hmm. who placed him there and his political beliefs that they're, you know, divinely legitimated. It doesn't matter because he's in that position of power. So
there's a perception that betrays the reality, isn't there?
I think so in some ways.
Yeah, because in a way, and again, just like Michael's saying, you say this in your book, there's almost that one line of or that one line of thought that says, hey, it's shrinking. Right? It's not growing. And but before you pull out your fireworks for the party, Those who do have that are now in positions of power. They get to espouse the rhetoric. They get to push it forward. And it feels like, oh, this is the water I'm swimming in. And everybody thinks like this. And like you said, those in power are able to then make those decisions that follow that unhealthy mindset. Yeah. So looking forward for this new era, what are some of
is that said tongue in cheek or
well, because if I say new era, that makes it feel like it's this new and recently happening thing. And as he has now written not one but two books and many, many papers establishing that this is not the case, it's been long in building. What would be a piece short of, hey, read my book to hear a fuller answer and don't give away your conclusions or anything. But like what are some encouragements, maybe two or three encouragements that you have since this book is specifically written for Christians?
Yeah.
How do you encourage us to live in an era where power and fear and violence are at play?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I think, you know, one relatively, you know, I think it's a piece of relatively low hanging fruit that we can do is continue to reach out and listen to and read books by and listen to the voices of those who differ from us in various ways. And so recognizing that Greg Boyd, you know, uses this metaphor of your map is not the territory. And so understanding that our understanding of our social worlds or even the world at large, that's our map. But that doesn't mean that we don't have areas of our map that are not filled in or have blind spots. And so one thing that's been so helpful for me on this journey is to, not necessarily force myself, but to be cognizant of who I'm reading. So reading folks who differ from me in some respect, whether, you know, reading books by women as they're experiencing Christian faith and how they see their world and the experiences they've had, or racial and ethnic minorities, things like that, because that helps me. So I grew, you know, I can't control who I was born as and how the world was shaped and how I move within it. But hearing those experiences of others helps me start to realize that not everybody else experiences the world like I do. So as a white Protestant man, there's not a whole lot within the U.S. that is off limits to me in some way, right? Doesn't mean that I haven't had to work hard or anything
right,
else.
Right.
But the experiences of others, right, within Christianity or within the United States, I can hear those stories. And I think that can be helpful to Christians to recognize and to hear those voices, and then to think through the implications of that, which, you know, as a social scientist, I guess this is probably right at the forefront of my mind, but that an individual's experiences, they generally are part of a larger community. And so that those experiences aren't just happening in a vacuum, but likely others are having very similar experiences. And so this helps us to think, you know, at the system level of how our social worlds are creating systems or have been created that produce these outcomes. And so when I see the marginalization and suffering of immigrants or refugees, that doesn't just happen by accident, right? And they aren't just unique soul experiences, but others coming to these shores are having the same one. So how can we as Christians begin to recognize holistically how we can live for and serve those who are coming here, by one example. But to do that, we have to listen to their voices. We have to practice empathy to understand that we may not know what we don't know, and how else can we find it if they don't tell us? And if we don't listen with with empathy and care. And so I think, yeah, starting with what we listen to and read is one great part. And then in our organizations, I'm beginning to look around us and thinking through, well, who are our neighbors? Where are we placed? And not in a way to justify ourselves, like it's told in the gospel, but to try to expand that definition. And I think that's what Jesus was trying to do as well, expand the definition of who your neighbors are. And so hopefully that's my hope for Christians here in the United States.
Well, thank you so very much for writing a book that is truly confronting something that lots of people are scratching their heads on. They're unsure of how to deal with. It is around us, but also providing us a way to run in towards Jesus, the one who has been obscured or blamed for a lot of the ills that we see befalling us. In fact, he is still beautiful. He is still good. And he is calling us to a better way. Mm. Andrew, if people are excited by what they've heard and they've already read Taking America Back, they've are now buying American Idolatry, where can they follow you to keep up with what you are doing?
Yeah. So I'm on various social media outlets. So Twitter or X, I'm still on there, but increasingly trying to find a way
yes.
out there based on where it's been taken. But I am there on Instagram. And then I have a Substack that I'm starting. And I think that's where I'll be spending some more time rather than Twitter/X. So Andrew Whitehead and .substack. And it's named after the book American Idolatry. So yeah, folks can follow me and some of the work that I continue to do through those channels. And then too, just a quick plug, I recorded a 4-part podcast about Christian nationalism called American Idols. And it's available kind of wherever podcasts are downloaded. But the first episode describes what Christian nationalism is. The second one is the threat to democracy. The third episode is the threat to Christianity. And then the fourth one is what do we see coming?
And yeah. Where do we go from now here? What?
Yeah. So for folks that just want to hear a little bit more, those are available as well.
Dang. Dr. Whitehead, thank you so much for joining us. It was a joy to have you. Michael and I were glad to dig into this topic a little bit more. Glad that you have given us these places to come and continue to follow you and your work. For those who are listening, and also mainly because we had such an awesome guest, maybe this is your first time on Ephesiology, we invite you to look back or listen through our many episodes that we have had on the Ephesiology podcast, where you can go online to masterclasses.ephesiology.com to kind of see what the online theological educational experience through Ephesiology is. We have a lot of resources, and we want to continue to equip you to what God has called you to, where you are in whatever field that is. So for Michael, Dr. Whitehead, and myself, thank you for doing theology in community with us today on the Ephesiology podcast.